Welcome to Recovering Queen, the podcast where we take a well-known and not so well-known Queen track, do a cover version of it, and then talk about what we've learnt, the methods and the madness of the greatest band of all time, Queen. My name's Ian, and with me are Matt and Jay.
Hello.
Good evening.
And which song are we doing tonight?
Tonight, Ian, we're doing Death on Two Legs, open brackets, dedicated to, ... close brackets.
Now, not only is this one of the many, as we've discovered, bracketed Queen songs, this is one of those weird songs where Death on Two Legs is such a huge song, such a huge Queen song to Queen fans, yet almost completely unknown to anyone that's not like totally into Queen. They'll have never heard this song.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? Can you remember the first time you heard it? Because I actually can remember the first time I heard the album version.
Not the album version. For me, it was the Live Killers version that introduced it to me.
Yeah, well, Live Killers version is the first one I ever heard. And when I heard the album version, I actually thought it sounded slightly dated. And
I think if that's because the live version rocks out a bit more. I don't know.
I think it's because the double-tracked vocals on the chorus, at the time, that was such a sort of old-fashioned technique. It sounded dated, but I can't actually hear that anymore, but I just remember the feeling of it.
I just remember the on the Live Killers version where he's beeped it out and being, what, young teenager thinking, oh, wow, what rude words did Freddie say, and being fascinated by what he actually said, which is, in fact, very, very rude, and we won't repeat it tonight.
Do we actually know what he said?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, do we know what he said?
He said a...
Oh, do
boop,
we?
Boop, boop. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's well, he introduced it the same way virtually every night. And it was, yeah, not at all complimentary way of introducing somebody. No,
you're just but what was it? Well, you can't leave us hanging like this.
Because something, presumably.
It's something like this next song is about a real... of a... referring to Norman Sheffield, the owner of Trident Productions, who were in bed very closely with Queen through 1970 till about Night at the Opera time, when they were unceremoniously fired and countersued and sued, and it all went horribly wrong. I've just finished Life on Two Legs, Norman Sheffield's book, to kind of, in inverted commas, setting the record straight about his time with Queen. Because obviously, if you read the lyrics of Death on Two Legs, it's pretty damning, and poor old Norman has had to have that on his shoulders for the last, when did the book come out? 2013, I think the book came out. So, he's kind of been Mr. Death on Two Legs.
So when was that? When did Norman Sheffield take the band to court?
It was, they sued to get released from the Trident publishing and recording and management deal. It was all really bizarre. It was destined to fail, essentially, because no one was interested in Queen. Trident took a chance on them, gave them free studio time, invested the equivalent of hundreds and thousands of pounds worth into them to try and break them, which obviously relatively successfully. But the way it all works, obviously, you don't see much money for a long time, and Queen were getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but feeling poorer and poorer and poorer.
The whole sort of point where it all started to get out of hand is when John Deacon wanted to get married, and all he wanted was a £4,000 advance, and it was refused.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, the guys from Trident were driving around in Rolls Royces.
Yeah.
And that was for Roger Taylor. That was the what the hell moment. Yeah,
yeah. It was kind of the final straw. But I mean, I'm going on Norman Sheffield's version of events, which obviously, you know, that's somewhat biased from his side. But my understanding of it was they were driving around in Rolls Royces anyway, because Trident Productions and the studio in particular were enormously successful. It was like the place to record in the 70s. So that was a huge company. They moved into outside broadcast. They were opening new studios.
So you would have thought that they had the money to lend John Deacon £4,000 to get married.
Well, it was £4,000 on top of the equivalent of millions that they were investing weekly, almost, in the group. Again, this is all from Norman Sheffield's side. But it was destined to fail because, if you think about it, they had a publishing deal through them. They were recording with them. The record label was through them. And they were being managed by them as well.
Yeah.
So it's just it's just a massive conflict of interest on all sides. So it was destined to fail. And as Norman says towards the end of the book, he says, which band doesn't have a dispute with a manager or a record label at some point during their career? And it's like all the successful ones do.
Yeah, I mean, it's that thing, isn't it? If you've got one party that's representing things where there is a conflict of interest, or you can't manage and be the label and be the publisher and be the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
No, ludicrous.
Without there being a huge conflict of interest. But I still think, you know, when you read about it, about how poor, you know, the Queen had come back from Japan, where they were being adored, like a massive tour of Japan, yet they were having to borrow money off people to get taxes to the studio and stuff like that, you know, to actually get around. They weren't making a living wage despite having hit singles, successful tours, et cetera.
All I can say is it's an interesting read. I highly recommend it to any Queen fan. There's a lot of things that ring true, just how ambitious Queen were, how demanding they were, and you can see that through the whole career.
Oh yeah, you don't get big without being
like that,
without being demanding. But I do think, I mean, talk about shooting yourself in the foot.
I know.
You look after your talent. It's like that. That is pretty obvious, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you want to. They had another 5 albums to go as well with them. That was the deal they did. So
when did all this happen? When did Queen and Norman Sheffield go to court? What are we talking about? 1975, 1976?
Yeah, 75, 76. But because obviously Queen didn't have enough money to, say, buy themselves out of the contract, they bought themselves out of the contract over a number of years, which does reflect quite well on Trident, because they could have, like has been done thousands of times before, you know, managers and labels can just sit on bands' output and just say, right, well, until this court case is all sorted out, you can't release anything, which they didn't do. You know, they said, okay, you can move, you need to buy us out, but you can do so over a number of years. So they didn't do too badly.
I wonder if there was ever a time that Brian and Roger actually saw Norman Sheffield after the court case. Yeah, and what would they have said to him?
Yeah, they did.
Oh, sorry,
Brian acknowledged it later on. I forget what the event was, but he said something like, in a big crowded room full of people, without this guy, none of this would have happened.
Yeah, that sounds just like a Brian thing, something that he would do.
Yeah, but it made Freddie so angry. He wrote a song, which I love the lyrics to Death on Two Legs.
Oh,
I think
it's great,
anyone who's got a bad boss can really relate to them. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can stick that on and go, yeah, this is my boss. It's great. And Freddie really meant it. According to Mike Stone, his ears were bleeding by the end of it because he was having the mix so loud in his ears to get so that he could really get riled up. But according to Freddie, it was his throat that was bleeding at the end of it, not his ears.
Right.
So there's a little bit of... So whether there was any blood at all is a little bit debatable.
He might have cut his finger.
Freddie's clearly furious, isn't he? He's got a real bee in his body about it. And the benefit is we get Death on Two Legs, which it's up there with the very best of Queen, I think. It doesn't get much better in the whole catalogue than Death on Two Legs.
No.
Yeah, for me, this is definitely one of the best lyrical Queen songs there is. You know exactly what Freddie is saying from the start right through to the end. It is so beautifully acerbic, cutting. As you were saying, Matt, you can stick it on when you're having a bad day with your boss, and you're going to feel a lot better by the end of that one if you sing along to it. So yeah, a lot of the songs I do think are open to interpretation, a lot of the Queen lyrics, I should say. And I think that's a good thing on the whole. But here, you know what Freddie's saying, and it's delightful.
Well, I think just the variety of insults that he gets in, it's astonishing.
Yeah, I mean lyrics like, you misguided old mule with your pig-headed rules. just absolutely, just love these lyrics. And another great one is a sewer rat decaying in a cesspool of pride.
Yep. That's a beauty, isn't it?
Yeah. I tell you what, that there's something about those lyrics that are very Roger Waters. And that was, I really noticed it when I did my version of it, that when I'm singing it, it's like, yeah, it's got that Pink Floyd, really angry person about it, which is very unusual for Queen. Virtually all their songs have a kind of romantic or fantasy feel, particularly from that era. But to be genuinely angry is a rare Queen emotion. And that's why Death on Two Legs is such a gem, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Am I right in saying, Ian, that actually this song caused more problems with Norman Sheffield, that he actually tried to sue to stop it from being released, and so therefore it delayed the album?
No. So it didn't delay the... They delayed the album enough themselves. I mean, it was barely, the wax had barely set by the time they had to get the album out of the door to do all the touring and everything commitment. So it was released, and then Norman Sheffield was so shocked by the content, quite rightly, you know, you can understand, that he did sue for defamination or some defamation, whatever it's called, that word. And they settled out of court. But in order to do that, he kind of had to reveal that, guys, this is about me. Yeah, he was kind of identified as the person that the song was about, which caused him a bit of pride and a bit of embarrassment in equal measure, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean...
But Trident went on to strength. You know, it didn't really affect business in the short term. You know, it was still the creme de la creme studio for rock music for best part of the next decade, really. Well, I suppose you should be flattered, really. I mean, I'd love to have a song written by Freddie about me.
Yeah.
If it was complimentary, that'd be nicer. I'd still take a right roasting off
him. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Particularly with lyrics like those. Oh, my God. Yeah. The one thing about Death on Two Legs is that it is a lot more complicated than you ever realise it is. So how on earth, Matt, did you cover it?
Well, do you know what? It is complicated, but it's not that hard, actually. I don't think. I was quite surprised how quickly I did it. Because we laughed, didn't we, when we first allocated it?
Yeah.
About, oh, this is going to be really difficult. But what I did was... luckily, I was acting as studio engineer to get the piano part down. So what I did with George is sat him down and he learnt each couple of bars there and then we would put it down, and then we'd do the next couple of bars and he would put that down, and then we'd put the next couple of bars, and I'd just be stitching the piano parts together like that.
For the benefit of the listeners, George is your teenage son.
And then once he'd gone away and got fed up with me, I ended up having to re-record the verses because he didn't quite swing in the correct way on the ding, 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 ding. So I had to re-record those, which was great, actually. I thought it was going to be really difficult because obviously that left hand is as a counterpoint to the right hand. But once you sort of get in it, it's actually... reasonably easy to play. And the drums
are just all over the place for the it barely settles down into a beat.
Everyone is really good on it. It's great piano playing by Freddie, like really good. It's great bass playing by John Deacon. He's starting to do that thing where he's putting notes all over the place and creating like real harmonic interest. Brian is really, really pushing the envelope in terms of the sounds that he's making. Like all those pinched harmonics at the beginning, all those kind of weird, kind of very, very quick vibrato parts, the solos, everything is just absolutely awesome. I mean, that was by far the longest to take, and I'm really not that happy with a lot of it, but I'm not going to get it much closer than that. I mean, Brian was, he's really absolutely killing it on that. And like you said, Roger Taylor is brilliant, but I think one of the sort of breakthrough moments on it is just how good the drum sounds are on that album, so that they're able to do those punctuated tom fills that sound really musical and... virtually nothing else going on when you've got like toms going on.
Yeah, incredible. One thing I noticed about Roger's playing as well, right at the very start where the drums kick in, very simple drum beat. He doesn't do that thing with his hi-hat.
No.
He doesn't do his open thing just for that first bit. It's like, so he can do it. He just hardly ever does it, or he can not do it. Slightly raise his foot in, you know, in sync. I always thought it was this like involuntary thing that he did, but on when it's the verses, he's not doing it, and then it does it throughout the rest of the song. But just on that bit, so he's obviously made a decision to play it straight almost.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Roger Taylor choosing to do the open hi-hat on the snare a lot, but that is his signature sound.
Yeah, yeah,
isn't it? I mean, let's face it, you know it's Roger Taylor because virtually no other drummer does that particular trick.
No one does it. It's weird. It's weird. We've mentioned this before, that you never really get a sense of Roger's snare sound because it is so entrenched in the combination of his snare and hi-hat that he doesn't really have a signature snare sound. But when he plays his snare, you know it's instantly him because the hi-hat trick.
Yeah. I mean, for albums around at the time, the sound quality of Night at the Opera is just absolutely brilliant. And it's obviously not the studio because they've recorded it in about three or four different studios.
Yeah, it's all over the place, isn't it? Yeah.
Obviously the skill of Roy Thomas Baker.
And is this the first album where they are free of Trident? So is this an explosive...
They're not free of them at this point, but they're not recording at Trident. So,
well, bits of it are. Bits of it are at Trident. I think
it's only the God Save the Queen.
God Save the Queen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's the only... That was done the year before. But yeah, everything else, it's like Rockfield for the backing tracks, I think, and then the Psalm. Yeah, and the Psalm Studios as well.
Yeah, yeah, and it seems to me that, as you mentioned, Matt, they're all at the top of their game on this one. They're all playing, the compositions are fantastic, they're all playing out of their skin. And I reckon that this is that whole episode with Trident coming out, this is fuel for this whole album.
Anyway, so a bit of history then. They worked through, was it August, September and November working on the album. It was released on 21st of November 1975. And then they go out on the road extensively touring in across Europe. But they're not playing it live at this point. Oh, no. It gets
really?
Introduced to the, yeah, it gets introduced to the set at the back end of the Night at the Opera tour when they hit Australia the next year in April. April is the first live performance, and at that point it becomes a staple of the live set for years and years
so
and years.
It's so good as a live track. I mean, yeah, live killers.
I know, but you say that, but what are they going to drop? I mean, they've already had a few albums out by then. What are you dropping?
Yeah, exactly.
When did they drop it?
Well, that was my next quiz. You know?
No, I've got idea.
Ian's quick quiz. When did they last perform the full version? Because they kept on doing a little teaser up until quite late, actually, of just the introduction. But the last full song performance of Death on Two Legs was...
I'm going to say it would have...
79.
I reckon later. I reckon they were still playing.
Any advance on 79?
I'm saying that they still played it on the game tour.
Once again, Matt, your Queen instinct is top notch.
Get it.
It was their final performance was in Brazil in 1981 in the game tour, playing it a total of 243 times in total.
Wow, that's an epic Queen fact. What I love about Death on Two Legs is that it's got a guitar riff that's a single note guitar riff. And at the time, when I was a sort of young guitar player trying to write guitar riffs, I always thought that it had to be power chords. And it was like, what? You can write a riff that's a single note. And it sounds really powerful. And it's like, yeah. That's actually like an amazing thing. And I remember being like amazed by that time. And it's like, well, listen to how powerful it sounds just doing one note in harmony with the piano and the bass at the same time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And it's, to me, it's so counterintuitive because when I was growing up, I'd be listening to... you know, some heavy metal or rock bands of the 80s. And it was all about, you know, creating these really big sounds and chords with a little bit of a dirge, really. But Brian he shows the way again with this technique. And you know, melody and the way that you do it can be just as powerful, basically.
So that's interesting, Matt, that you've learned, even by doing a cover as authentically as you possibly can, it still illuminated something quite profound.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I think for something like Death on Two Legs, to do the cover as closely as I could was more beneficial. I just don't see how you could improve the track. It's just about spot on, isn't it? Everything's great about it. The vocal performance is terrifying. Yeah. It's the guitar playing's absolutely superb. The drumming's amazing. And John Deacon yet again pulls out this just absolutely spot on, really musical bass part.
And don't forget, you can get in touch with us on the Twitter at Recovering Queen to tell us what you think about this track or any of the other tracks we've covered. And anything Queen in general, we're always up for talking about the greatest band of all time.
Indeed. Shall we have a listen to Death on Two Legs?
Let's do it. Listeners, this is Matt's version of Death on Two Legs, dedicated to...
Blood like